From 90.7 WFAE Charlotte, 90.3 WFHE Hickory, welcome to Charlotte Talks. I'm Chris Clackham, sitting in for Mike Collins. It's a little slice of Charlotte history, but it sure had a profound effect on the country's history. Nearly 100 years ago, the U.S. Army needed places to hurriedly train soldiers for World War I, and one of those places was not that far from the intersection of Trade and Tryon downtown, a 2,300-acre piece of land that lay between what would become Wilkinson Boulevard and Takasegie Road. Camp Green was, even by today's standards, huge, even though it was never much more than a tent city, a temporary tent city at that. But within months of opening, 60,000 soldiers would pour in from all over the country for infantry training at Camp Green, a far greater number of people who lived in Charlotte at that time. And it set the city on a path to do something it has done every decade since, and that is grow. Let's jump right in on this discussion, what Camp Green meant back then and the effect it has had to this day. Jack Dillard is a documentarian. He is the director, producer, the chief person who honchoed the documentary City of Canvas, The Story of Camp Green. Jack Dillard, good to see you.
Good to be here.
Jane Johnson is a librarian at the Robinson Spangler Carolina Room, the Charlotte Mecklenburg Public Library, and has a pretty good grasp of the history of Charlotte, especially around the time of Camp Green. Jane, great to see you.
Thanks for asking me to be here.
Let's first of all paint a picture for us of what Charlotte was like just prior to the war, World War I, and before there was a Camp Green. Jack, start us off.
Charlotte was a bustling mill town, let's say. It was the center of textile world at the time. I think there were 300 mills within 100 miles of Charlotte. So it was dominated by textile activity. On the street, you would find horse carts. I mean, it was still a country town. Horse carts and streetcars. There were a few skyscrapers that had already emerged. So essentially, it was an active but small town, 35,000, 34,000 population in 1910.
And skyscraper is relative. How tall of a building?
Well, the Independence building.
The old Independence building that went down in about 1981, 1982 or something like that?
Right. I couldn't tell you exactly how tall that was, but that was one of the first, and it was up at this time.
Okay. So this is the summer of 1917, and Jane Johnson from the Charlotte Mecklenburg Library System. Was this the very first big get for the city of Charlotte from a standpoint of like someone at the Chamber of Commerce would view it?
This was a wonderful Chamber of Commerce moment. We had people from the federal government that looked at the whole country to decide where were the best places to put camps, and Charlotte was chosen. We had fabulous weather. We had some land that was available. The people here had promised some infrastructure to make it easy to get to the camp. We already had railroad lines, and we had people that were willing to support the camp.
But from the standpoint of the city has always tried to attract something that would churn the local economy, Camp Green and the 60,000 soldiers it would attract would certainly churn the local economy. But was it the very first big sort of a move that helped Charlotte's economy, or was there something else prior to that?
I would say that probably getting the mint to make coins for the federal government was probably the first big get for Charlotte. But certainly getting Camp Green was the largest at the beginning of the 20th century.
What were the demographics like at that time, Jack? The demographics of the city. What was the population? How many people lived in the region, that sort of thing?
Well, the 1910 census population was a little over 34,000. Mostly they were farmers or, you know, rural folks. The neighborhood, there were several neighborhoods, but it was a very compact city at the time. Dilworth had already been established. Myers Park had just been established, I think.
Cotswold was out in the country?
Cotswold, I don't think, was one of the neighborhoods at that time. Mm-hmm. Elizabeth, Biddleville, I believe, were others. So it was a very compact town at the time, mainly, you know, in the uptown area.
There was read in one part of the research about a mother in Huntersville. I'm surprised that that community was already in place in 1917, but Huntersville was already there. Cornelius was there. Met Hill, Matthews, Pineville.
I think so. I mean, very small communities, but yes, they were.
There was a lot of distance and a lot of openness and a lot of nothingness between the city of Charlotte, for example, and the town of Matthews, right, Jane?
Correct.
How spread out was Charlotte at that time? As you said, though, Jack, very, very compact.
Well, even if you went past what's now current 277 on the west side, that was basically the end of town. You would see Elizabeth Mill, which is now where the Charlotte Law School is, and then it was just fields and farmers. So this was where they decided to put Camp Green because you could actually see downtown Charlotte from that location, just like you can today. It was a high location, good drainage. There was a creek that ran nearby. It was just a perfect place to put it. There was also space for an airport because we were teaching people how to fly.
Mm.
And I don't think a lot of people realize that. The airport is where the Freedom Mall was, which is now where a county building is, close to 85. Off of Freedom Drive.
The airport was first in that location as opposed to where it is now.
Correct.
Way off.
It was close enough for the soldiers to be able to march there and then get on a plane and learn to fly.
Okay, so let's talk about Charlotte at war at that particular point in time. Not sure how quickly Camp Green was conceived and built after the war started, but where were we in the summer of 1917 as far as where World War I was?
Well, the war actually started for America on April the 6th, 1917. And when Woodrow Wilson declared war, it was immediate that they needed to build training camps for the soldiers to be prepared to go to France.
How many training camps around the country? Was it about three dozen?
32.
32.
Right. Some of those were National Guard area, and some were regular Army.
National Guard, meaning that they would stay at home? They would not be transported and participate in the war overseas?
No, they would. The National Guard, in fact, the first division that came to Camp Green was the 41st Division. It was a National Guard group from the western states, Wyoming, Washington, Oregon, et cetera. And it was a tent city for that particular group from the very beginning. But they started arriving in September of 1917 after the camp was hastily constructed in 90 days, I think it was. 950 buildings were built. The soldiers were required to live in 16 by 16 tents, eight soldiers to a tent. And that was decided, it was a cost-cutting measure. And they assumed that the winters in the South would be more temperate than other places. Boy, they were wrong.
Yeah. As it turned out, I mean, the weather did play a huge role in the history of Camp Green, and we'll get to that in just a few moments, but a 16 by 16 tent.
Correct.
And how many men per tent?
Eight men per tent.
And 16 by 16, it was it just an elevated, you know, board?
There was a wooden platform that the tent came out of, and in the center there was a stove that, you know, often caught the tent on fire. In fact, but eight soldiers to the tent.
Okay, and you said how many buildings were constructed in this 90-day period of time?
Well, the original order was for 940, I believe it was.
How many of those were the actual tents?
those were not the tents. Those were mess halls, stables, you know.
A hospital?
Yeah, there was a base hospital that was built there. The thing is, almost immediately, we almost lost the camp and had to raise more money to get more land to expand the camp. And originally, the camp was supposed to be for one division. That was the original intent. But Camp Green served three divisions. So, you know, it kept expanding and overflowing to other parts of the area.
But you say almost lost the camp. How did Charlotte almost lose the camp?
Well, we were announced. I mean, it was announced that we got the camp. 10 days later, the Army said, "No, we need more land," and so they scrambled, raised $75,000. Gastonia, Belmont, and Mount Holly all contributed to raise that money.
From the stamp, what was the sales pitch? I mean, and who was contributing that money? Was it the
business leaders primarily, I think? The Chamber of Commerce had gone after this with all guns blazing, so to speak. There were 35 delegates that went up there to land the camp, and then, you know, and then we got the camp. Then had to scramble to keep it, and even later on, I think the city of Savannah tried to take it away, and we blocked that as well.
You said there were 32 such camps in many states across the country.
Right. Most of them in the South.
Most of them in the South. Again, Jane, because of the weather.
You needed weather, and you also wanted it to be easy to get them into France. It would have been senseless to take them, say, to California, and then have to transport them back across the country to get them overseas.
So location also applied back then. Were the 31 other camps that were constructed, how many were there in North Carolina?
Camp Green was the only full divisional camp in North Carolina. South Carolina had three.
South Carolina had three. There were actually three cities in the running to become a camp for the World War I effort, but we beat out.
We beat out Fayetteville, Wilmington, Athens, Georgia, and actually Syracuse, New York as well to land the camp.
But in Fayetteville's case, they went on to become Camp Bragg and then Fort Bragg.
Later on during this same period, there was an artillery unit established there. So that was the foothold for.
I am trying to also get a sense of how much bigger was Camp Green compared to the 31 other camps.
Well, it was the only camp that supported three divisions, so it had to have been, you know, bigger. I can't tell you exactly how much bigger, but the camp grew to 6,000 acres.
6,000 started out at 2,300 acres and grew to 6,000, which, like you said, Jane, was necessary for the training of all those people and housing all of them.
Correct, because you also needed a rifle range and an airport and
an artillery range.
Talk more about Camp Green right after this.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Goddard School, offering childhood preparation needed for social and academic success. Learning for fun, learning for life at the Goddard School, goddardschool.com. Monday on Charlotte Talks, guest host Chris Clackham is back in the studio. He'll be guest hosting Charlotte Talks just as the papal conclave begins the process of selecting a new pope. And while many worldwide speculate on what this means for the future of the Catholic Church, we'll talk about the history of papal conclaves and the many ways that this one will be different and how it could affect the future of Catholics everywhere. That's when Charlotte Talks, Monday morning at 9 on 90.7 WFAE. If you'd like to join our conversation today about Camp Green, give us a call now, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or online at wfae.org/charlottetalks.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, government agencies brace for sequestration. Chuck Hagel is sworn in as Secretary of Defense, and we remember former Surgeon General C. Everett Koop.
Join the Diane Rehm Show and the News Roundup this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks, here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
We're back on Charlotte Talks. I'm Chris Clackham, sitting in for Mike Collins, and our guests today include documentarian Jack Dillard, who is the author, director, producer, whatever, of that documentary called City of Canvas, The Story of Camp Green. And Jane Johnson is joining us, too. She is a librarian in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Public Library System and was instrumental in getting the exhibit on Camp Green organized at the library. There's still plenty of material for folks to come by and see, right, Jane?
Absolutely. And we do have a website for people that are out of town or can't come by. It's called cmstory.org.
And if somebody wants to watch the documentary, Jack, they can do so?
Right. There's a website, and I'm going to give you the site. It's media.nclive.org. And if you go there and put City of Canvas in the search, it will come up. You will need to have had a library card to view this thing, but it's out there now.
All right. U.S. becomes involved in World War I, April the 6th, 1917. What month are we talking about that a delegation from Charlotte, when they get word that the U.S. Army is looking for training grounds, so to speak, what month are we talking about, and what do this people in the city of Charlotte do to go and convince government leaders that this place would be a good location for one? Jane?
Jack, I think late June of the summer, David Ovens was part of that delegation, Cameron Morrison, Mayor Frank McNish, and others. That went up there to wrangle with the the government delegation.
Something that I also read was that Camp Green, there was an it was infantry training at Camp Green that was going on, but more specifically, trench warfare. That the way that the doughboys soldier of World War I was going to be fighting the enemy was essentially from trenches, and that they were dug out at the area at Camp Green for this express purpose.
That's correct. The war in Europe had waged for 2.5 years before the United States got involved, and much of it was trench warfare, where they would get in the trenches, move up, build more trenches, get closer, and shoot from them. It was really an older style of battle that changed with this particular war. World War I, as it came to be known, was the first mechanized modern war.
What was the other type training that went on at Camp Green, though, other than trench warfare?
They did bayonet drills.
There was actually a rifle range?
There were rifle range. There was artillery, big artillery. That was built out in the Kings Mountain, Gastonia area, 36 miles from the camp. The rifle range and small arms range was closer to Gastonia, near the Catawba River, and I think that was 12 miles from the camp. So the soldiers would march over there, do their shooting, and then march back.
Jack talked about a few moments ago about all the buildings that were needed for Camp Green. Jane, what effect did that have on local employment, so to speak, local businesses that were looking to supply the materials for that, not to mention the food, the housing, and whatever that was needed for the construction workers, for example?
Well, there's actually a company in Maryland that got the contract to build the camp, but of course they needed local workers and materials. So people could show up, local citizens could show up and offer to help literally cut wood, you know, do carpentry, sell wood. They needed coal to heat the fires that Jack mentioned in these little stoves. These soldiers needed everything. They got one light bulb per tent. I mean, it was huge. And not only that, because the people got passes to come into town, they were eating at our restaurants. They were putting money in our banks. They were dating the women in town. They were going to churches and synagogues. And it was just a huge event that just kept going day after day. And I don't think our people quite realized the long-term impact that it would have.
How quickly did the camp grow to 60,000 soldiers? I mean, once it became functional and once it was open for business, so to speak, as a training camp, how long did it take for it to reach 60,000 troops?
It never probably was 60,000 all on one day, because as soon as people reached their training goal, then they were shipped out. So we had people learning to bake in large quantities.
Mm.
And that training may have taken a short amount of time. And then off they would go to France. So there were people constantly moving in and out of the camp. And early on, because we had a lot of these men that were coming from the far west, they already knew how to shoot guns. And they were already part of a trained, mechanized group. But when you start taking men from big cities who don't own a gun, who've never shot at all, it takes more training to get them ready to dig a trench and to use a bayonet and to fire a rifle with some kind of accuracy.
Jack?
The 41st Division, which was the first one that came in in September, and they left in October. So they weren't at Camp Green all
I was
that.
Getting ready to ask you about how long was their stay here. Was the average stay 5-6 weeks, something like that?
Well, the training was set up to be a 16-week program. So the 3rd Division, which came in next in November, and then shortly thereafter the 4th Division came in December. That's when – early December is when the camp reached its peak population.
And what figure was that?
Well, I mean, I've seen it 60,000, but the fact is nobody really knows.
The numbers
were coming and going all the time. At least 45,000, I'm pretty sure, because each division was 28,000 men. Not all men came to our camp. They, in some cases, they caught up later on as they were being mobilized, but for at least a time there was 45 or so thousand in the camp.
Jane, were they literally catching planes from this airport, which is off of a Freedom Drive, and going directly to Europe for participation in World War One? What was happening?
No, they were actually just learning to fly planes
and build them.
And
fix them, because a lot of these people had no experience.
So the bottom line is, the way that these soldiers were transferred over to Europe was by boat.
Yes, they would go up to New York, most likely catch a ship and...
Not Wilmington.
No.
It was mostly New York City.
And they would catch the train and go from our train station.
Do you have any writings, articles, interviews, anything like that give you any clues as to what the soldiers who were coming from Oregon and California and Idaho and Wyoming and all of these places, what they thought of the Charlotte area? Also, there was a rather large contingent, as I recall, from the Northeast.
Correct. Those from the North certainly were very surprised by the weather that hit, from December to February. The guys from out west weren't here very long, but they were embraced fully by Charlotte, that first group that came. The others, as the war bore on and citizens realized the horrors of war. The 3rd and 4th Divisions didn't get quite the special treatment that 41st Division did. So, you know, they mingled well, you know. Citizens in Charlotte, Mount Holly, and Belmont invited soldiers out for Sunday dinners. Charlotte basically shut down on Sundays. So if there was anything to go on, it was going to happen, you know, at someone's home for a meal, et cetera.
So to your point, Jane, earlier, that soldiers were indeed not just restricted to the confines of Camp Green. They were going in and they were participating in the city of Charlotte at that time.
Yes, and Charlotte actually benefited in an unusual way. We didn't have restrictions on health codes at the time in our restaurants, and one of the commanders at the camp refused to let the men come into town to eat until Charlotte cleaned up its restaurants. And so they did, because they didn't want to lose all that money. We also had local stores that were selling things to the soldiers, such as socks and things that they might want to add to their uniforms.
Right. Belt Brothers, in fact, billed themselves as everything for the soldier, you know, uniforms, et cetera. And they were on Tryon, second Belk store was on Tryon. And so they went after the business pretty strongly.
That's Jack Dillard, documentarian, author, director of City of Campus, The Story of Camp Green. Jane Johnson is with us, too. She's a librarian with the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Public Library System, and we're talking about Camp Green. If you want to join our discussion, our phone numbers are locally 704-926-WFAE. That's 926-9323, or outside of Charlotte, 1-800-603-WFAE. That's 603-9323. Get us online at WFAE.org. You've talked a lot about the weather at that time. Now let's get specific.
Okay.
Well, I mean, how bad was it, and when did it get so bad?
Well, when the 4th Division arrived at Camp Green, there were 5 inches of snow on the ground early December. That winter, there were 16 ice events or snows, and for long periods of time, the temperature never got above 32 degrees. Often it was in single digits. So for 2 or 3 months there, the weather, you know, played a big part. And in fact, it got so bad for a while that they had to stop training. And the fact is, after that, once the snow started melting, then another problem arrived, and that was mud.
Red clay mud,
an inch to a foot deep in some instances, and that made any footing treacherous. So again, training was delayed for a certain period of time.
Not to mention the harsh conditions of having to live under those circumstances at those temperatures and those. I would not think that a 16 by 16 tent with one stove in the middle could be very effectively heated with temperatures and weather like that.
No. I mean, they were given blankets by the Red Cross, I think, delivered a whole bunch of blankets to the soldiers. I can't imagine what it would be like, frankly, you know.
You were talking about the impression that folks from outside Charlotte coming to Camp Green for their training, their impressions of Charlotte. And you mentioned specifically that the folks from the north and the northeast in particular were very surprised by the weather down here. One of those had to be a soldier who would later become the mayor of Charlotte, that he liked it so much. Tell us about that.
Okay. Herbert Baxter. Trained at Camp Green. Part of his training was at Camp Green. When the war was over, he came back to Charlotte. I think his business was the lumber business. Built that up pretty well, and was elected to at least two terms as mayor of Charlotte. During his time in office, the Independence Boulevard crosstown highway was started.
Were there others, Jane, notable, that came from other places, liked what they saw in Charlotte, even though they were stuck in an army camp in a 16-by-16 tent?
Well, we did have some race car drivers. There were people from, say, like Indianapolis that had raced cars. And when they came down here, they had to keep men busy and happy and entertained. So they would have little races in downtown Charlotte.
Are you suggesting here that Camp Green had something to do with the the eventual concept of NASCAR?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We had people who had been trained boxers and fighters, baseball players, football players. I mean, this was a citizen-soldier war, so we had men of every type and every background come.
Not to make too light of the subject at that particular time, too. I mean, this was something, this cold weather was something the South was not accustomed to. Did it make it that much more difficult for everybody to adapt out at Camp Green?
I think it must have. It was, if I remember correctly, the lowest temperatures in 40 years during that 1917-1918 winter. So, you know, there were cases of pneumonia, early cases of the flu that season as well, which was another big story.
Everything that you read in the literature and see in your documentary, everything points to this being a boom time in the city of Charlotte. Is that an accurate description?
I would say so. I mean, it was lasting contribution. You know, it was not only the population boost. I think right at the end of the war, it was a 25% increase in the population from the 1910 census, and then quickly it was doubled. You know, within a decade or so. Also, just the expansion of manufacturing and other business opportunities arose. I believe there was a big jump in building contracts as well.
Some of the businesses that we still have today, you mentioned Belk Brothers a few moments ago, becoming the chief supplier of all things military, they existed prior to Camp Green's development?
Belk got started in Monroe, but the second store, I think, came to Charlotte. Within a couple years of the war's end, they had, I think, 12 new stores, and they had doubled their sales within that period of time.
We also, Jane, had a huge jump in population because of Camp Green from a soldier standpoint, but other people were moving here too, weren't they not?
Absolutely, because whenever you take soldiers out of the population, then you need other people to start working to take their place.
We're back with more about Camp Green on Charlotte Talks right after this.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and James McElroy & Deal, a law firm helping individuals and businesses avoid problems, overcome obstacles, and minimize consequences for over 50 years. JMDLaw.com. Coming up next at 10 o'clock in about 20 minutes on the Diane Rehm Show, it's the Friday News Roundup. A panel of journalists will join Diane for analysis of this week's top national news stories. And then at 11 o'clock, she'll take an international focus. That's the Diane Rehm Show coming up in 20 minutes at 10 here on 90.7 WFAE. Well, imagine March without a WFAE pledge drive. It is possible with your support. Last fall, your early pledges eliminated half the drive. So why not all of it this time around? Go to WFAE.org to make your pledge. And if our $550,000 goal is met before the start date, there will be no drive. You can make it happen. Go to WFAE.org. And thanks.
What's this?
Public Radio Remix. The best public radio stories, documentary audio, big ideas, and cool sounds.
Now they're both in a trance. Perhaps they're listening to another dramatic radio episode.
A new kind of public radio. Saturday, 9 to midnight on WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Chris Clackham, sitting in for Mike Collins. Our guests today include documentarian Jack Dillard. His documentary, City of Canvas, The Story of Camp Green, is available at media.nclive.org. Jane Johnson, librarian with the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Public Library, talking about Camp Green, one of the buildings that we pointed out earlier, Jane, that was constructed out at Camp Green, was a hospital. But you're saying there were other hospitals that were constructed in the area.
There were many hospitals, because one of the things that happened during this war was the flu epidemic, and it was a worldwide flu epidemic. So we had people that were not only just sick from regular diseases of living around other people, but we had people coming back from France who had been injured, and we also had just soldiers that were really sick. So they needed more than one hospital. And at the time, we had the biggest medical facility in the whole state of North Carolina, because we not only had our local hospitals for Charlotte people, but we had this whole hospital system out at Camp Green.
When you say the biggest in North Carolina, meaning the camp hospital at Camp Green?
There were many base hospitals at Camp Green. And then we also had our own hospitals here in Charlotte. So there were more doctors probably in the city of Charlotte or Mecklenburg County at that time than any other place in the state.
Was the hospital constructed with the intent on treating the wounded from World War One? I didn't realize that. Was that the intent of that, Jack?
Not initially. It was a base hospital, which actually burned down, and they rebuilt one on the other side of the Tuckasegee Road that was a bigger one that was going to be a convalescent center. So as soldiers demobilized, I guess the term is, wounded soldiers came there to recover, and it was a 1,000-bed hospital, if I believe, that particular one.
Again, if you want to join our discussion about the history of Charlotte as it relates to Camp Green, a huge Army training camp on the west side between Wilkinson Boulevard and Tuckasegee Road in the summer of 1917, training soldiers to go off to war in Europe in World War One. Our phone numbers are 704-926-9323 or 1-800-603-9323. Catch us online at WFAE.org. You mentioned one hospital building burned down. I would imagine that because so many of the structures at Camp Green were built out of wood,
correct,
that fire was a true hazard.
Absolutely, and that went for the tents themselves with the stove in the middle. Many of those caught on fire, but the hospital was a big deal. And then they decided at that time. The 3rd and 4th Divisions had left for Europe, and so the camp was a smaller camp. They decided to build that extra-large general hospital at that time.
Now, the flu pandemic of 1918 obviously was to soon follow the opening and operation of Camp Green, Jane. What are we talking about? Flu pandemic, meaning worldwide flu problem, big time.
Well, we had people in Charlotte that were ill, as well as the soldiers at Camp Green. And the soldiers at Camp Green who passed away from the flu and whose bodies were not reclaimed by their family are actually buried at Elmwood Cemetery.
At which cemetery?
Elmwood.
Elmwood Cemetery, located?
Right off of 77, and the front door, the front entrance is on 5th Street, I believe.
Right. How bad of a problem are we talking, though, worldwide with the flu pandemic?
There are estimates between 20 million and 50 million, to be honest with you. They don't really know how many people died. The United States did not get hit as bad as some other countries. I think I read somewhere that one village of Eskimos, 70% of them died. Things like that. So,
but there were soldiers and support personnel who were actually passing away from the flu in the city of Charlotte and more specifically at Camp Green.
Right. Fortunately, at that time, there were fewer soldiers, and so I think almost 300 men died, and there were probably 5,000 cases of the flu, something like that, at Camp Green. Now, what caused real problems were the soldiers were sent, to other camps or sent to be sent over to Europe. And so they were in close proximity to one another on trains and on the ships, and many of them got sick or spread the disease that way.
Was the camp ever quarantined?
The camp was quarantined, and so was the city. And it ended right before Armistice Day, the day before.
11-11?
Yeah, it was 11-10-1918 is when the quarantine ended.
All right. Let's go to the phone lines. Brian has been holding and wants to join our discussion about Camp Green and World War I. Brian, thanks for calling in.
Yes, sir. Good morning, folks. How are you?
Doing great.
Good. Mr. Taylor, you said about documenting, but I was wondering, is your work in the book, do you have a book out doing with Camp Green?
No, I do not. There is a book that was written by Grace Mitchell called The Echo of the Bugle Call. I don't know that it's still in print, but it's certainly in the libraries around this area.
Well, I might try to see if I can get the documentary. I've done some research myself on mostly men from eastern North Carolina, where I'm from originally. A lot of those were in units of the 81st Wildcat Division. But did you ever, on doing your study, did you ever work with Cy Harrington and Colonel Ripley at Archives and History?
Absolutely, with Cy particularly. I shared my collection of things with them, showed them what I had, and they also allowed us to use some of the photos that they have in their collection in Raleigh.
Very good. Very interesting program. World War I is one of the time periods I've always been interested in, and
I'm
enjoying the show very much.
World War I is sort of the forgotten war in a way. It's between the Civil War and World War II, both of which still have folks clamoring about those wars. World War I, again, was a horrible war, the first modern war, and when it was over, people wanted to forget it, and they did, and went on with other things, and then the Depression hit shortly thereafter.
But Brian, anybody who's a fan of Downton Abbey should be a fan of learning more about World War I history, because Downton Abbey is taking place in England, of course, at the end of World War I. Brian, thanks so much for your phone call. Let's
yes,
go back.
Sir.
Yeah, thanks,
Brian. You'll have a good day.
Thank you. Thank you. Let's go back. So, again, Jack, how many people in the city of Charlotte affected by the flu? I don't want to get too far off that subject because it was such a huge issue at that time.
I think in Charlotte there were about 5,000 deaths. 50% of the soldiers at the camp contracted the disease. And approximately 50% of the citizens of Charlotte contracted the disease. It hit hardest the age group from 21 to 35, which is unusual for influenza. It usually hits the older populations and the younger populations. Now, some of those folks also died, but it hit that younger group, soldier group, in fact, pretty hard.
So here we have this situation in the city of Charlotte, Jane, and we have people living in close quarters. Do you think that contributed to just how bad it was in the city of Charlotte, the flu one?
Absolutely. They had to close down movie theaters, churches, schools. I mean, they wanted to keep people home and away from other people. And so, because people were living so close together, and you had people that were often, having large families. If one person got the flu, it could affect all of them. And actually, most people didn't literally die of the flu. They died of pneumonia, which was caused by the flu.
Jack?
Charlotte was lucky in a way. It hit Philadelphia and Boston really hard. Mm. And they did no preparation. They didn't know what had hit them, and so they had not made any steps to prepare for it. By the time it really hit us, you know, we had the advantage of knowing sort of what we were up against, and so the quarantines went into effect and other measures.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Jennifer in Huntersville is calling in. Jennifer, thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for having me. A while back, a good friend of mine who's unfortunately passed, David Rich, he lived in a house that was on the Camp Green site, and they actually had a museum of some of the artifacts from Camp Green on the first floor. And I was wondering if that house is still being maintained.
Correct. It is. It's the Dowd House. It's the only remaining structure from the camp, and it is a museum by appointment only. But David Rich was responsible for preserving that particular building.
R-I-T-C-H, David Rich.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. And the Dowd, was it the actual headquarters building for the officers, Jack, or what?
It was originally a construction headquarters. There were two other houses that were headquarters. Help me here, Sid
Alexander
House, and also the Berryhill House later on were headquarters for one division or another.
And Jennifer, you've been there?
Yes.
And you can see the uniforms of the Doughboys. You can see photographs of Camp Green. Read all about it there.
That's right. It's an amazing place, and it's a shame that there aren't more people like David around to work on preserving Charlotte's history, because there's a lot of amazing history in the city.
Fantastic. Jennifer, thanks so much for your phone call. One of the interesting things that you would see in an exhibit your room, the Carolina room at the Charlotte Public Library downtown, the panoramic photographs that are of incredible quality, and here again we're talking about from 95 years ago. How did they pull that off, Jack?
Well, it was a special camera called the circuit camera, and it had a rotating camera, and the large format film was processed and synchronized to the movement of the camera itself to go past the lens in a long sweep. So you got these images that were 3 feet, even up to 5 feet long sometimes.
Talk a little bit more about the documentary itself, Jack.
Okay.
City of Canvas, because the tents were made of canvas.
Correct. This was a project that found me, basically. You know, I liken it to a stray dog that followed me around on a long walk, let's say, and I would shoo it away and turn the corner, and there it was again. Now, Jane helped push me a little bit on the project. Once I got the script finished, she set a meeting with WTVI, and it went from there.
And you got some Governor Pat McCrory, whose grandfather served at
That's
Camp
correct.
Green.
Walter McCrory served at the Remount Station. He was a
pharmacist.
He was a pharmacist, and they thought when he wrote it down, they thought he wrote down farmer, and so they put him with the Remount depot where the horses and mules were kept.
So why did you push Jack, Jane?
I felt like it was a story that needed to be told, and I thought it needed to be told in a similar style to a great documentary, and I knew Jack had the background and capabilities to do that, and he loved the subject.
And so let's move on here very, very quickly, because I do want to talk about what happened after there was no more Camp Green. Did the city of Charlotte suddenly go into shambles? You had literally tens of thousands of fewer residents here. What were the conditions like shortly after it closed and even long after it closed?
Well, as soon as the armistice was signed on November 11th, 1918, there were still men that needed to be sent home. And so it was just this massive starting to pack up and ship out people. Well, by February, they started auctioning off basically everything that they didn't need anymore, except for the hospital staff and the sick soldiers. And then by July, it was basically all gone. And because the Army had leased the property of the Berry Hills and the Alexanders and some of the other folks over there, the Dowd family, the Coxes, I believe, lived there maybe at that time, then they got their land back, and life went on as normal, except all of a sudden you had infrastructure. You had telephone lines and sewers and streets and lights, and basically all the trees had been cut down because they needed the lumber.
But you didn't have too many customers, so how did the city survive?
It was a bit of a shock to see that many soldiers leave so fast, but Charlotte was on its way. It was on the map. And, and they quickly recovered.
And we can at least agree that Camp Green was at least one of the very first big gets for the city of Charlotte.
And I think the federal government was pleased because we did it again for World War II and got Morse Field.
Jane Johnson from the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Public Library, thanks so much. Jack Dillard, thanks so much. I'm Chris Clack. I'm sitting in for Mike Collins on Charlotte Talk.